Hello, on this week's program, Jason Pfeiffer visits Painted Metaphors, Pottery and Politics of the Ancient Maya at the Penn Museum in Philadelphia. Susan Lewis takes us to Juxtapose, a new program by Philadelphia's contemporary Gene Ruddy Dance. It features a premiere by world-renowned choreographer Martha Clark. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns explores the latest developments in the story of a Paul Hindemith piano concerto and how the only copy of the piece came to be found in rural Pennsylvania. And we visit the Marian Anderson Historical Residence and Museum. This weekend marks the 70th anniversary of the celebrated Philadelphia-born contralto's historic concert on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
This week, the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology opened a major new exhibition called Painted Metaphors, Pottery and Politics of the Ancient Maya. The objects in the show have long been part of the Archaeology and Anthropology Museum's collection, but as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the reinterpretation of more than 150 artifacts from Central America is yielding fresh insights into an ancient culture.
Strolling into the Painted Metaphors exhibition evokes the sense of another time and place. Music drifts from nearby speakers, performed on whistles that are actually artifacts in the collection. At the center of the room is a circular arrangement of clear display cases, offering a 360-degree view of over a dozen ancient pots, many decorated with elaborate images and figures. It's compelling enough, but why a new exhibition with items that the museum has had for nearly 100 years? Painted Metaphors explores the great Maya civilization, which originated over 3,000 years ago and spread across Central America, Mexico, Honduras, Belize, and Guatemala. The Penn exhibition is largely based on the work of Robert Burkett, an archaeologist who, starting in 1912, excavated the region for over 25 years. Burkett researched ancient Maya culture in Chamá, a remote village located in the highlands of Guatemala, a locale that Painted Metaphors curator Ellen Danion says went largely unexplored by archaeologists until the early 1900s.
In fact, at that time, very little had been done in Maya archaeology. So we were among the very first institutions in North America to look at the Maya and begin excavating.
Among Burkett's discoveries in Chamá, says Danion, were items of broken, painted pottery, unlike other ceramic artifacts found in the region.
And we now know that it was made for only about 50 or 100 years, around 1,300 years ago.
Danion says with the help of widespread research and new technology, archaeologists have learned a lot since Burkett's time. 100 years ago, scholars couldn't yet read Maya writings, and they thought the ancient civilization had been an empire that eventually died out.
Today, we know that it wasn't an empire. The Maya did not disappear, as many people believed. They were a group of city-states that had various alliances and warfare among themselves. They used hieroglyphs that are syllabic rather than alphabetic. And in the last 30 or 40 years, we've been able to decipher almost all of them, so that we no longer can talk of the Maya as prehistoric, because now we know all sorts of things about them.
The Penn Museum exhibition highlights such insights about the Maya, particularly the ordinary people from Chamá and their everyday lives, along with exploring how traditions from over 1,000 years ago remain among the Maya's descendants today. The Penn display also includes ancient musical instruments, jade jewelry, incense burners, cups, bowls, figurines, weaving implements, and of course, painted pottery. Seven of the Chamá vessels in particular are renowned among archaeologists because they know exactly where the pottery was found. Specificity is important to scholars, and Robert Burkett did a good job documenting his discoveries. While Chamá pottery can be found in other collections around the world, most of the artifacts are the product of looting, and their exact origins are uncertain. Some of the most striking Chamá pottery includes detailed painted scenes with reoccurring characters and illustrations, seeming to depict the arrival of new rulers from the Maya lowlands. The designer of the Painted Metaphors exhibition, Kate Quinn, used the images from the ceramic vessels to create a theme for the show, painting the enlarged characters on the exhibit walls.
It helps you to realize, I think, that they were chosen for a reason. They were painted. Someone took a brush to a pot and painted that for a specific reason. And they were headlines of their time, just of the everyday people, trying to give them messages of what was happening in the world.
As metaphors for Mayan politics, religion, music, and day-to-day life, Ellen Danyon says the pottery was not merely for show.
Decoration is something that we do in the 19th, 20th, and 21st centuries. Everything that the Maya did had a purpose. It may have been strictly utilitarian, it may have been symbolic, it may have been something for the gods, but everything had a purpose. They didn't just hang a pretty picture on the wall.
Besides highlighting the pictorial narratives and aesthetic beauty of the Maya artifacts, Painted Metaphors also explores the science of archaeology with informational videos and replica pots that visitors can try piecing together themselves. When Robert Burkett excavated the Chamat pottery, the vessels were broken into hundreds of pieces. Someone had to reconstruct the jugs, bowls, vases, and cups. A conservator, Lynn Grant, Penn Museum's head of conservation, says by the 1990s, the original preservation work was no longer holding up.
I had to take all these artifacts apart because the old adhesives that had been used were no longer stable, and the pots were literally falling apart in your hands. Every time you touched them, more pieces came off.
After disassembling the ceramic objects, Grant and her team carefully documented and cleaned the pieces. They also ran tests for food residue, like chocolate, and used multispectral scanning to look at how exactly the pots were painted. And then they had to reassemble the pottery with better adhesives, similar to piecing together a jigsaw puzzle, a three-dimensional one, that is.
Do you like jigsaw puzzles, by the way?
Of course I like jigsaw puzzles, and I especially like them when you have the picture on the box and they have edges. These jigsaw puzzles are a lot more difficult.
Grant says that this Maya exhibition will have a life beyond Philadelphia. It's slated to go to other museums in the coming years, so some heavy-duty preservation was required.
As conservators, we practice what we call minimum intervention. We don't do any more to any artifact than is absolutely necessary. But with a traveling exhibit where we know that they're going to be packed and unpacked and installed and deinstalled multiple times, there's going to be much more handling. So we carry out a higher level of conservation than they would if they're going to a one-time exhibit.
Grant says it could be tough to find a balance between the at times competing goals of educating the public and preserving historical artifacts. But curator Ellen Danyon thinks it's well worth taking the exhibit to audiences beyond Philadelphia, profiling the painted stories and everyday objects from the remote village of Chamat.
It shows part of the culture that usually isn't recognized, and I think it's important to realize that when we study history and we only look at the mountaintops, we miss all of the valleys and the hills, and this is part of those valleys and hills.
New stories from old artifacts. This exhibition demonstrates that our knowledge is continually evolving, and that sometimes yesterday's truths become today's myths.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Painted Metaphors, Pottery and Politics of the Ancient Maya will be at the Penn Museum through January.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Philadelphia's Jean Ruddy Dance this week begins its new concert season and the third program of a three-year series of premieres by renowned guest female choreographers known for their avant-garde work. This year's program features Sandman by Martha Clark along with Lark, a new work by the company's founder and artistic director. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at Jean Ruddy Dance and Juxtapose, its program pairing these two distinctive styles of modern dance.
Jean Ruddy performed around the world as a principal dancer in the Martha Graham Company, experience she believes shaped her as an actress-dancer.
She plumbed the world's best stories, Oedipus and Jocasta, Medea and Jason, and I danced those stories, and they live inside me.
Ruddy taught at both the Alvin Ailey Dance Center and at Juilliard before putting down roots in Philadelphia, where she formed Jean Ruddy Dance in 1999. In telling her own stories, she says craft and technique are very important to her.
And the geometry of choreography, where it goes on the space. I like a clean-looking ballet. I like a ballet that you can remember some of the shapes. So there's a great deal of architecture in what it is I do.
She's also sought out guest choreographers to explore different perspectives on modern dance. This year's program is the end of a series featuring
three risky women, I like to call them, or iconoclastic women. We started with Jane Comfort in 07, and in 08 we brought in Susanne Linke from Germany, another extremely well-known choreographer internationally, and now Martha Clark.
Trained at Juilliard, Martha Clark was a founding member of Palabolas Dance Theater, known for its weight-sharing body contortions. She's choreographed for the Netherlands Dance Theater, American Ballet Theater, and the Martha Graham Company, among others. Martha Clark's art is less conventional dance, more movement theater.
Or theater movement. Yeah, I think of myself as more a director of dancers than a choreographer because there are no quotes from any technique. I choreograph as a series of images rather than a combination of steps.
Influenced by visual imagery, Clark is drawn to European films from the 50s and 60s. Her well-known work, Garden of Earthly Delights, references the work of Dutch painter Hieronymus Bosch. And Sandman was inspired by evocative images in photographs.
The first day that Martha came to work with us, she brought books of the work of Dion Arbus and a number of costume pieces and rubber masks and things like that.
Dancer Janet Pilla.
She just asked us to look through the book to see if there's anything that interested us. And so I found one beautiful photograph of a little boy sitting on a rock outside with a very grotesque Halloween mask and huge grotesque hands. So I thought, And so one of the things that was there to play with were big hands and a mask. And so I just crouched down and started to build this character which came out of the mask and the hands.
Characters take shape through exploration, discovery, and play. Clark likens the process to painting with performers' bodies.
I begin to see things as they move. I may like a lot of depth, and I'll put one dancer at the far end of the stage and another one as far away as I can, and then I'll say, lower your head, and then you go backwards, you go forward, and you see, you kind of push and pull. It's very much like painting.
But a painting moving right in front of us.
Space is very important, rhythm is very important, and then the why of the motion. What does the gesture tell us?
Sandman evolved into a work about dreams and childhood fears.
Like a child seeing a witch's face in a tree in the pattern of bark, or the way branches will look scary on a winter night when you look out the window and cast a shadow with the wind blowing. It's about a kind of naive, primal fear that everybody has.
A woman sits making a cross with stones. A man with a bag on his head appears to be wrapping up a body. A small masked figure scuttles furtively from behind the stage.
It feels a little bit like an open piazza at 2 in the morning.
Instead of designing movement to fit with music, in this work, Clark has called in a sound designer to create sounds to accompany the movement and imagery.
We've liked the sound of people walking, or the sound of thunderstorms, or the sound of church bells. It seems more evocative with what this piece has become. When I worked with music, it was too metered, too even for them to do actually work as actors on top of a meter.
In contrast, music was one starting point for Gene Ruddy's work Lark. Lighter in mood than both the Clark and many of Ruddy's own earlier works, it references Joseph Haydn's String Quartet No. 5 in D major, but with a contemporary twist.
I love the Haydn. I just didn't want another modern dance piece to a Baroque piece of music.
Ruddy asked composer Ellen Fishman Johnson to create a modern reimagining of the Haydn for her contemporary company.
I just think it's time that modern dancers ought to be dancing to current music, music that's happening now.
To that music, Ruddy has created movement that speaks to the nature of human relationships. Janet Pilla dances a duet.
Thank you.
we're dancing together facing each other. We circle around each other, and we go past each other. There are a series of lifts, which are enjoyable to do. Sometimes we come together and go apart. We react to what each other is doing.
The two ideas that really come across in Lark, at least I hope they do, is the longing for connection between people and exploring that space between us and how we can close that space between us. It's abstract, but it's in the dance, but it's absolutely visible.
Two premieres by two choreographers, juxtaposed. Contemporary explorations of how modern dance and movement interpret life's journey through both the darkness and the lightness of being. Whether reaching out with an artistic language evolved through the century, or plumbing the depths of dreams.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Juxtapose is at the Performance Garage at 1515 Brandywine Street in Philadelphia from Wednesday through Sunday, April 26th. After more than 80 years of obscurity, a Paul Hindemith long-lost but now rediscovered piano concerto has finally been recorded for the first time, thanks to pianist Leon Fleischer and the Curtis Symphony Orchestra under Christoph Eschenbach. Concurrent with its late April release on the Ondine label is the Alexander Wall book The House of Wittgenstein, about the wealthy but suicide-prone Viennese family whose household had visitors such as Brahms and Mahler, and whose son, Paul, commissioned music from the greatest composers of his day. As previously reported, the story behind Hindemith is strange, but according to the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns, it keeps getting stranger.
The pieces of this puzzle may never come together. The Hindemith Clavier Music Meet Orchestra was brought into being by Paul Wittgenstein just as he was starting a second performing career. During World War I, his right arm had to be amputated in the thick of battle, followed by a torturous recovery in Siberian prison camps. But as he commissioned Hindemith, Britten, Ravel, and Strauss, he didn't graciously accept whatever he was given. He never played the Hindemith Concerto, but refused to let anybody else do so either. The final puzzle piece concerns the 2002 discovery of the score in a remote, gated estate, not in Bucks County, as previously reported, but in more distant Newfoundland, PA. One's incredulity over how it ended up there is followed by the miraculous fact that it did, so many years after the piece was stillborn. The Curtis Institute of Music's David Ludwig, who is a composer and teaches 20th century music, has made a particular study of Hindemith's Clavier Music Meet Orchestra. I asked him to put the music into context. Obviously, this piece was the project of a somewhat different Paul Hindemith than the one who lorded over the Yale University faculty after he fled Nazi Germany and settled in America.
1923 is already 10 years after the Rite of Spring, 11 years after Pierrot Lunaire, so I don't find the music to be particularly avant-garde. But I understand, you know, Hindemith was not afraid of dissonance. And Wittgenstein, as far as I understand, was noted for particularly conservative tastes. So, because with Prokofiev, also, he, you know, had him commission a piano concerto and said he didn't understand that either. So, I think the meeting of those two things is why the piece was shelved for so long.
The Alexander Wall book says that Wittgenstein gave the piece a shot, but was horrified. Quote, "After many hours of diligent practice, he decided the music was simply incomprehensible and canceled the scheduled premiere. There's no reason to think that he looked at the music or even thought much about it for the rest of his life. But when another similarly armless pianist asked for the rights to perform the Prokofiev concerto, Wittgenstein refused, saying, 'You don't build a house just so that someone else can live in it. I commissioned and paid for the works. The whole idea was mine. Constructing this house has cost me a great deal more money and effort. I was, in any case, far too generous with contracts, as in the Ravel case, and I am now being punished for it.' Wittgenstein thought about commissioning music the way one possesses a painting. And keep in mind, this was a family whose rarefied sense of reality was such that when one of the daughters was painted by the great Gustav Klimt, She didn't like the way the mouth turned out and brought in somebody else to fix it. Similarly, Paul Wittgenstein made his own changes and additions to the works he commissioned, even the best of them, such as Ravel's Piano Concerto for the Left Hand. His reference to being punished for his generous contract with Ravel meant that he failed to negotiate lifetime exclusivity. His concert engagements were drying up. The Ravel Concerto grew increasingly popular in performances by other pianists, and, as this live 1937 recording of Wittgenstein suggests, his playing was in decline. I suggested to David Ludwig that Wittgenstein's obsession with exclusivity had to do with insecurity about his own playing.
I know that his reputation declined as he got older, but that's a really interesting theory because that would then allow a lot of people to play the music better than you played it. And I know also that he objected strenuously to people making two-hand versions, because that would give a certain kind of advantage in terms of the sonority that you're creating. So it's true that by sharing these pieces, he would allow people to one-up him.
Ability aside, you have to wonder, what kind of music did Paul Wittgenstein like? Before he lost his arm, he made his Vienna debut with a concerto by one John Field, whose music has nice tunes, but was old-fashioned even in the age of Chopin and Liszt. Though at odds with Hindemith, Paul Wittgenstein did go to great lengths to keep this piece from being lost when the Nazis marched into Austria, and he, being of Jewish heritage, emigrated to New York City. The family had converted to Catholicism generations before, and some of his siblings, what was left of them since three brothers committed suicide in decades past, stayed in Vienna, and paying for their protection cost much of the family fortune. Besides that, musical manuscripts were considered national treasures and couldn't be taken out of the country. But because Hindemith had left Germany in protest over the Nazi regime, his manuscripts had a good chance of being destroyed. Perhaps that happened. What survived in Wittgenstein's personal effects when he died in 1961 was a somewhat inept, perhaps hasty copy of the original. Lucky thing, too, because the piece is more than just a curiosity, says David Ludwig.
I think it's a really interesting work by a young composer at the time who's had a lot to say. And it's such a great story that goes with it. Not every piece has a story or background as sort of interesting as this.
But wait a minute, the story isn't over. The piece had another 40 years before being discovered. The widow of Wittgenstein moved from a genteel section of Long Island to remote Newfoundland, PA, where, as one of her neighbors told me, she wasn't the friendliest person in the world. She was also isolated, first by her blindness, then by Alzheimer's disease. And though Wittgenstein married well outside his social class, his children seem not to have escaped the family genes. One daughter died mysteriously. Paul Jr. spent time in a psychiatric ward and moved to Europe to become a painter. Behind those gates on Hilltop Road, the widow, it seems, was hiding from something. Her children? Herself? Or something else?
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Paul Hindemith, Klaviermusik mit Orchester, Opus 29 for Piano Left Hand and Orchestra by the Curtis Symphony, conducted by Christoph Eschenbach, with pianist Leon Fleischer, is released on the Ondine label on April 28th. Alexander Waugh's book, The House of Wittgenstein, is now out on the Doubleday imprint. On Easter Sunday, 1939, the great Philadelphia-born contralto Marian Anderson sang a historic concert from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, after being denied permission to sing to an integrated audience at Washington's Constitution Hall, maintained by the Daughters of the American Revolution. That concert will be commemorated on Sunday with Denise Graves reprising much of the program Anderson sang 70 years ago. But the most permanent memorial to Marian Anderson in Philadelphia is at 762 South Martin Street, where the great singer lived as an adult, across from the church that nurtured and encouraged the young singer's early career. Anderson's home is now the headquarters of the Marian Anderson Historical Society, which tells her story and continues her legacy with outreach programs to support young classical vocalists.
Ich stand an dem Gestade und sah in süße Rohr.
Franz Schubert's Die Forella, a performance by Marian Anderson from January of 1951. No one would question the idea that Marian Anderson was, in the traditional original sense of the word, truly a diva. Yet in her own South Philadelphia neighborhood, she was best known for her modesty. When Anderson would return to Philadelphia after touring the world, she would still sing in her local church choir and take an active interest in her neighborhood. Anderson made a huge impact on one little girl in particular in that South Philadelphia neighborhood.
When she'd come home from her tours, she'd have my mother bring me up here, and she would chat with me, "Little Blanche, how are things going? What are you playing now?"
Blanche Burton Lyles is a concert pianist and founder and president of the Marian Anderson Historical Society. Lyles bought Marian Anderson's house in 1997 and opened it to visitors. Lyles' mother was the pianist at the Union Baptist Church, where a young Marian Anderson first began singing. Members of the congregation immediately realized that Anderson's voice was so extraordinary it would merit a fund to support her formal training. This fund would ultimately pay for Anderson to train with private teachers in the US and Europe. On her return from Europe, Anderson began a path that would eventually lead to international stardom. In 1924, she bought a home on South Martin Street in South Philadelphia, directly across the street from the church where she had started singing. Phyllis Sims is curator of the Marian Anderson House.
This house she purchased for her mother in 1924, and together they lived here for over 60 years. And this is where she stayed, you know, when she came to Philadelphia.
Late in her life, Anderson married architect Orpheus King Fisher, whom she had befriended when she was 15. Fisher designed the paneling in the parlor room of the house. Visitors to the parlor can peruse photographs of Anderson with Albert Einstein, Paul Robeson, and assorted dignitaries. But as Phyllis Sims walks us through the house, she explains that Anderson did most of her entertaining not in her parlor, but in her basement.
It was fashionable for blacks to fix up their basements because, you know, they weren't allowed to the various restaurants and things during that period. And this is what we call the Marian Anderson Entertainment Center. At the time, of course, there was a bar and table and sofas and chairs.
On the wall in the basement is a photo of Marian Anderson singing to a large crowd at the Lincoln Memorial on what is perhaps her most famous day.
She was in demand, and her concerts had been a sellout. So when she came back here and Howard University tried to find a hall suitable, they said, well, Constitution Hall would be great for the concert. Of course, they didn't allow her to sing there. They had never had a black there, and they weren't about to make an exception. And since Eleanor Roosevelt was a member of the Daughters of the American Revolution, who were the keepers of Constitution Hall, resigned. She used her political influence and worked with the Department of Interior, decided they would have it at the Lincoln Memorial and have it open for everyone.
The National Broadcasting Company brings you a song recital by the gifted Marian Anderson, considered by music critics throughout the world as possessing a most outstanding contralto voice.
Tomorrow's concert commemorating that historical event 70 years ago begins at 3 p.m. at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. In Philadelphia, the Marian Anderson Historical Society will also reenact the concert at the Tindley Temple United Methodist Church at Broad and Fitzwater Streets at 4 o'clock. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.